Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host, and we have a great show for you this evening. I do have to tell you right off the bat, though, Alejandro Rojas is generally on with us during UFO updates, and he has just been crazy busy. So he usually records his show, and I help him out on Mondays, and he was even too busy to do that. So he's been running around, a lot of changes in his life, and He, if all goes well, he'll be back next week as usual. I do want to say, if you are a supporter of the show, first of all, I want to thank you very much for that. It really helps us run. There are a lot of show expenses, and we are in the black, which is nice. I do want to say a shout out to Nicholas from London. Thank you for supporting the show. And I say that because he actually wrote me an email and said, hey, can you do a shout out? And I want to leave that open for anyone that supports the show. If you'd like me to do a shout out with your name, I would be glad to do that. There are so many people that help out. There's Keith over at the Dark Matter Digital Network. I've been on there. I think I'm the longest running show over there. There's Race Hobbs over here at KGRA Radio. There's Evan, who creates the graphic thumbnails for YouTube. There are there's Peggy, who runs the Facebook page. And countless people help me with little tidbits. As Palmer sends me interesting UFO reports all the time, and there's, I don't want to forget, Charles Lear, who writes great blogs, and we do have a blog up this week, and it's about historic monuments, including our first guest tonight, Kathleen Martin, and includes her aunt and her uncle's historic marker on the Betty and Barney Hill case, which is I think it's out in, I will ask her in just a minute where it's actually located. So it's about historic markers when it comes to UFOs. This is the Thomas Reed. I know the Pascagoula case has now a placard there, but it talks about that. So check that out over at podcastufo.com. Anyone else that wants to support the show, we are now on Patreon, and I just want to let people know that I just discovered, and I would have done this originally, I would have gone just on Patreon if I had known this. But at the time when I started doing subscription shows, they didn't have an ability to have an RSS feed, which really means what you can do is you can put my podcasts, my full shows, into your media player. They didn't have that capability back when I started this subscription that I have on my podcast website. So basically, Sam down in Peru helped me with that, created that, and also for Midnight in the Desert as well. It's the same system they have for a subscription service. It's been hacked into a couple of times, but I keep having to pay for different security for that. And so Patreon, that is a way to subscribe to this show, and you can also get the RSS feed right from Patreon itself to load those podcasts as they come up on your media player. And anyone can support the show. For that information, just go over to podcastufo.com. Over on our Facebook page, we have, I think, 22,500 likes there. So there's a lot of activity. You can get involved over there. And you can check out, there's news stories almost every single day of the week. I know during the week there is, and that's thanks to Peggy that helps out over there, posting new stories about UFOs and space and things like that. I'm a little under the weather myself. I have been for a while, but that doesn't stop me from doing the show and trying to do a good show. But it did stop me from looking up any current UFO stories. I just haven't been able to do that. So I will be back next week, as always. There's only one week I might have a problem with, and that's in December. Otherwise, I'll be running live shows every single week. And that's enough. Wait, before I get to introduce our guest, I should talk about Hour 2. And Hour 2 at 55 minutes before the hour, we go into a break. And during that break, we'll be bringing in our guests after that, which is Stacy Wright and Marianne Robb. They are from Phoenix MUFON. I hung out with both of them in Phoenix when I was out there a few months ago, and it's going to be a great, they're going to be great guests, I'll tell you that. So right now we're going to bring in Kathy Welcome to the show, Kathy.
Thanks. It's great to be back with you, Martin.
It's okay if I call you Kathy, or would you?
Sure. Yeah. That's fine.
Yeah. Well, I know we seem like old friends.
I know. All my friends do.
Yeah. And it's always, I've always enjoyed, I think you were one of my first 40 or 50 guests. After Stan had, I had Stan on the show, I said to him, he said to me, hey, you know, you really should interview Kathleen Martin. And I said, well, who's she? And he said, well, and he went on to tell me who you were. And I remember I contacted you and you said that if Stan suggested me, then I'm okay to be on your show. So,
And I, if you will remember, you did a live interview with me at my
home.
Father's house
in Newburyport,
Massachusetts.
That's
yes.
Right. That's right. And I want to say, first of all, I know how close you were to Stan, and I know it was a very big loss for you. And
it was
actually going into the Phoenix MUFON and seeing you sit by yourself. It really. It made me choke back a little bit.
Because, it did me too, I'll mm-hmm. tell you.
Because sitting beside you for years and years and years was Stan. And you two were so close. And he is missed. I'm sure you've really seen everything since he passed away of how many people have honored him and some nice things
yes.
out there about him.
There was a wonderful outpouring of support from people. So many people said that they went to him for help in some way, and he was always there, willing to listen.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, that was incredible. Hundreds of people.
Oh, I bet. I bet. The last time that I saw him when I did his retirement show up in New Brunswick on location, afterwards, he was very interested in me and what I did. I thought that was, I was there to interview him, and he was asking me all kinds of questions about, you know, what I do as far as antiques and fine art and stuff like that. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, it's a great loss.
It is.
Well, Kathy, for the listener, I know you've been on the show a number of times, but I will tell you, I get, with the amount of email I get, there's new listeners listening about this subject all the time these days. And so if you would, in a nutshell, if you would give your background and your, well, you can even talk about your aunt and uncle if you'd like to, but how this all started all the way back in, was it 1966? I get the years
1961.
61.
When this
66
happened.
66 was Socorro. I think
book.
That's, yeah, I get the
yeah.
two mixed up,
yes.
I think. Yeah. So go ahead if you would.
Yes, well, I had absolutely no interest in UFOs until I was 13 years old. And on the afternoon of September 20th, 1961, my Aunt Betty phoned my childhood home and told my mother that she and my Uncle Barney had a very close-up observation of a flying saucer the previous evening, and they were concerned that they were so close to that craft that they might have been contaminated. They asked my mother to call a neighbor of ours who was a physicist and ask him what they should do. And so that was my introduction to all of this. And I saw the unfolding of what happened, the emotional response that both of them had. Barney's ending up having post-traumatic stress disorder so badly that he had to take a leave of absence because he had bleeding ulcers. He was having great difficulty sleeping. His blood pressure was soaring very high, and it wouldn't recede with traditional medical treatment. I met just about all of the early investigators on that case, and when I was doing my own investigation, after I had worked for years, starting out as a social worker, then going into the field of education, doing graduate work there, I brought my career to an end. And I decided that I wanted to investigate this case for myself. I wanted to research everything that I could find on it. I wanted to drive the entire route. to do everything I could to debunk that story. And I couldn't debunk it. In the end, after transcribing all of the hypnosis sessions they had with Dr. Benjamin Simon separately, with amnesia reinstated at the end of each session, I compared their statements all along the trip. And I discovered in those transcripts that they had a real event. Mind you, there was lots of physical evidence and circumstantial evidence to support this, too, and scientific interest. But that is at the point where I had completed writing the first draft to the book that I wrote, Captured, The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. And that is when I went to Stanton Friedman, because Betty told me if I had any difficulty whatsoever in moving this book along, that I should contact Stanton, because I could trust him implicitly, because he was a top-notch researcher. And I had met Stanton back in 1972 when he spoke at the University of New Hampshire.
Wow.
So I had known him for years, but I had never approached him about anything like this. He didn't say yes immediately. He had to read my manuscript. He had to look at all of Betty's files that were in my possession at that point. She had passed away, and I was the trustee of her estate. And after much discussion, and I copied as many files as Stanton wanted and gave them to him, so they will now be in his archival collection.
Oh, wow.
In New Brunswick. But this all culminated in our book, and that was the first of five books that I've written.
Right, and
Stanton.
Stanton joined me in three.
Yes.
Oh, did he with three? Wow.
Yes.
One of the things about the Betty and Barney Hill case, and for the new listener that's not even familiar with any of that, there's so much information online. It was an encounter, as she said, back in 1961, as they drove through the White Mountains on their way back from Niagara Falls, was it, or someplace like that?
Yes, they went on vacation to Niagara Falls, up to Toronto, spent the night 112 miles west of Montreal, vacationed in Montreal for the day, and then decided to drive home to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, on New Hampshire's seacoast, because they had plenty of energy. They were well rested from the night before, and they thought they could make it.
Yep. And then this light appeared to be following them, and, you know, one thing led to another. There's been a movie. There's a movie, or is there actually another something in the works?
There was one movie written about that aired in 1975, the
TV
UFO
movie.
Incident starring James Earl Jones and Estelle Parsons. Bryce Zabel has the rights to make a new motion picture based upon our book, Captured, The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, which is a hugely expanded book over what was written by John G. Fuller in 1966. We know so much more now than we knew then.
Wow. Bryce is coming up on this show on November 26th.
Is he?
Yeah, he's a genius. I mean, he's scary smart.
Uh-huh.
and a great guy, and someone you really want to do a movie about an incident. So I'm really glad to hear it's in his hands. That's wonderful. One of the things about this incident, the Betty and Barney Hill, of course we'll get into other things, but one of the things that I think is so powerful about this incident in particular is that they did not want to go public. And do you want to talk a little bit about that? Because I think a lot of people kind of assume that, you know, they were attention seekers and, you know, that's what you hear, the sort of the debunking side
Yes.
kind of attack.
And just Just the opposite is true. Betty was a social worker for the state of New Hampshire. She certainly didn't want to place her job in jeopardy. Barney worked for the post office. They were both actively involved in the civil rights movement because Bonnie was black and she was white. And he was legal redress to the NAACP on the regional board. In 1965, he was appointed to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights for the State Advisory Committee in New Hampshire. And he was also actively involved in the community when he was one of the people who set up the Rockingham County Community Action Program with funding through the Office of Economic Opportunity. He was the first chairman of the board of directors to the Rockingham County Community Action Program and received an award from Sergeant Shriver. They certainly did not want to be thought of as a couple of kooks. This was always supposed to remain confidential until a friend of Betty's blabbed to a newspaper reporter in Boston. And it was for the Boston Traveler. He contacted Betty and Barney. He wrote a letter to them that I have in my possession, naming her, and said that she had told him a great deal of things about Betty's and Barney's account, and that he thought that it was probably the most compelling case on record, and he wanted to speak with them. Well, they were alarmed. How did he know about this? Mm-hmm. They certainly did not want to share that information, and they didn't. And unfortunately, he spoke to so many other people whom he probably convinced that this was being made public, that they spoke with him. He spoke to officers at Pease Air Force Base. He spoke between what he stated were 12 to 14 witnesses to the UFO that night in the same location where Betty and Barney saw the craft. And he knew that it was the same craft because he drew lines from where they were to the point where Betty and Barney were at certain times. And it intersected with their location and the craft. So that's fairly new information that Stanton found and gave to me when he was compiling his archival collection.
Yeah, I don't think I'd heard that. I know that there was some connection. I remember Lee Spiegel was telling me there was some connection at Pease Air Force Base. Well, I believe it was named in a MUFON report or something like that. Those are little tidbits out there. Were they, I want to say, how long did this last, the keeping it a lid on it before it got out there? Was it something like a few months or a year? How long was it?
The event was on September 19th and into the early morning hours of the 20th, 1961. The hypnosis session with Dr. Benjamin Simons began in January 1964, hypnosis in February 1964. The story was released as the violation of confidentiality in late October 1965.
Wow. So you're telling me that it was that long before this got out?
Yes.
That is amazing. I had no – that's news to me. I was thinking it was within a few months or a year. So that really does prove a really good point there that they were trying to keep the lid on it and really didn't want it out there. And how did their lives change when this got out?
Their lives changed drastically. It was devastating to them and to the family. They, to avoid the press, drove down to my grandparents' home in Kingston, New Hampshire. I grew up across the street from my grandparents. We met as a family to discuss all of this, what was going to happen next. Betty and Barney expected to lose their jobs, and they didn't, fortunately. In fact, the public accepted it, Betty thought, a lot better than she had initially believed they would. We as a family decided that they should at least speak about the UFO sighting they had. And so not long thereafter, they spoke at the Unitarian Church in Dover, New Hampshire, mm-hmm. and were introduced by the public information officer from Pease Air Force Base.
Mm. Wow. Wow, interesting. And from there, were there like TV stations that wanted them on and things like that? Did that happen?
Not initially. But John Fuller was in the audience. He had been writing the incident at Exeter. Mm-hmm. And he then approached Betty and Barney and gave them a proposal to write a book about their experience. And so Betty and Barney said they would only permit that if Dr. Benjamin Simon would agree to it and participate as well. So the four of them participated in the writing of this book and shared the profits from it. But John just pretty much copied the hypnosis transcripts, changing them somewhat. He was under pressure from his publisher. I found when Stanton and I went to his archival collection at the University of Boston University to enhance the story, to put more tension into the story, to fictionalize it enough to interest the public. And they actually said to him, if you want this book published, you need to alter it somewhat.
That's terrible. I mean, why would it need altering? That's the question.
I know.
You know, I remember I had a guest on the show, like, why would someone have to lie about UFOs? I mean, an incident when the incident is so amazing anyway. You know,
yes.
That's too bad when they're under pressure and they actually fold to the pressure. I'd rather see them not write the book than to get misinformation out there. I'm sure that's the way you must feel as well.
It is. And you know, that is one of the reasons, among many, why I wrote most of Captured.
Mm-hmm. And have you had to defend the honor, so to speak, of them, all, you know, year after year?
Well, you know, ignorant people, and I have to say they're ignorant of the story, have mentioned that, well, maybe Betty and Barney did this because they wanted publicity. You know, mm-hmm. a black man and a white woman married in 1961, actively involved in very good social and political activities in the state of New Hampshire, having jobs, having a high degree of credibility, certainly did not want to go public. They had plenty of money. They owned an apartment house. They, you know, were renting the apartments. They had good paying jobs. There's no reason for them to go public with this for attention or money.
We have about a minute before we go into our first break here. Can you tell me what it was like for them, in particular Barney, at the workplace after this?
Well, Barney was able to receive a transfer to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, from Boston. So there was a lot of prejudice toward blacks, from what I've heard from people who worked there, who contacted me and told me about that. And so he was happy, I think, to be a rural route carrier in Portsmouth, mm-hmm. and a mailman delivering mail. And there were people that really liked Barney. A lot of them called him Uncle Barney, the mailman. And they were very, very nice to him.
That's great. All right. Well, we're ready to go into break. And when we come back, we'll finish up a little bit about Betty and Barney Hill. And then we will talk about your book. So hang in, everyone. We'll be right back right after these messages. So, Kathy, we will jump back on that when we come back to the radio station. Let's see, to discuss another topic. You mentioned that you have written, this is your fifth book out now. Can you discuss a little bit about the other books that you've written?
Right now or on the show?
Right now. We're still on the show. We're on YouTube still live.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So, yes, my second book was with Stanton again. Science Was Wrong, Startling Truths About, Facts and about scientists who made proclamations of impossibility and were wrong. Then our third book is Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers. And that's based upon years of archival research that we did, because he visited more archives than I did, but I found a great deal of information at the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia, the correspondence files of people like the debunker, Philip Klass, I now know as a disinformant, Donald Menzel, disinformant, Edward Condon. You might say he was a disinformant, too. Mm-hmm. And Robert Lowe, who was the project coordinator for the Colorado study on the scientific study on UFOs. So we wrote those three together. And then I wrote one with Denise Stoner.
Oh, yes.
And that is the Alien Abduction Files. And now my fifth book is Extraterrestrial Contact, What to Do When You've Been Abducted.
Yes, and we'll talk about that when we come back after we finish up about Betty and Barney Hill. And I hope you don't mind talking about this subject. It's such a great topic. I find it so interesting. It doesn't get old for me. So if you're comfortable still talking about that. But I'm going back to...
Yeah, but I do...
Go ahead.
I would like to talk at length about my new book, too.
Oh, no, but we're going to. We have a whole half hour.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So I do want you to get into a little more about the archives, if you would. You said that you read some of these from some of these correspondence from some of these classic debunkers. You mentioned their names. What was so interesting? What did you find? Did you find anything that was hidden and kind of interesting that kind of calls them out and what they were doing?
Well, I was very surprised that they were all good friends.
That makes sense.
Donald Menzel was fishing buddies with Edward Condon. They were working together on this plan to debunk UFOs in the Condon Committee, even though later the Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics did a study on the cases that Condon covered and discovered that 30% of those cases were unknowns.
Wow.
And so, that certainly deserves further scientific investigation.
That does.
But Condon had a job to do, and I found all of the information that Condon had this job to do, what the Air Force wanted him to do. It's all laid out in our book.
Wow.
Now, we are ready to go back. Sorry to cut in there.
Okay, right. We're right here.
Kathleen.
Yep.
I've got to go back and read that book again, Martin. That's fantastic. All right. Here we go, you two. In 5, 4, 3, 2.
All right. Welcome back. This is Martin Willis. My guest now is Kathleen Martin. And before we went into the break, we were just wrapping up about Betty and Barney Hill, that whole case. And we're going to be talking about her new book and possibly take a couple of calls. I hope I'm ready for that part of it. He got up into Portsmouth, New Hampshire, which is an area that I lived many times in my life. I love that town. And what about Betty? What type of repercussions, if any, did she have at work?
She didn't have any repercussions at work. In fact, when asked, her supervisor said that he wished he had more just like her, that she was such a good social worker, and she ended up receiving a promotion to supervisor eventually. So it did not really have an impact on her job, which was very, very good.
That's wonderful. Now, did they end up being asked to speak? You mentioned the Unitarian Church in Dover, but was that was that something that grew in, you know, as you know, as actually conventions like that started to take place more and more?
Not really. The reason I say that is, it didn't really impact them until John Fuller wrote The Interrupted Journey. And then they were under contract to do many, many radio and television shows to publicize the book. It was later, and mostly, I believe, after Barney's death, when Betty went on the UFO speaking circuit.
I see. So it was mostly her.
Yes. Yeah, see, Barney died from a cerebral hemorrhage.
And
in
pretty young, too, right?
69. He was only 46 years old.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Yes.
Terrible.
It was terrible.
Hmm. Way too short. So she was asked to, and how did she take to that? Was she okay in doing that?
She loved it. She ended up leaving her job, retiring early, to devote the remainder of her life to the investigation of UFOs, the investigation of contact and abductions, and then went on the speaking circuit and spoke at many, many conferences.
Wow. Wow. That's really interesting. I didn't know that part of her. And how long when did she leave us? What year?
She died in 2004 from lung cancer.
Hmm. I know. I was in a home in Barrington, New Hampshire, and I saw a picture of a photograph of Betty, black and white, real nice one of her smoking a cigarette. And I said, "Oh, you know Betty Hill?" And they said, "Oh yeah, she was a friend." That was really interesting. Uh-huh. So she smoked a bit.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Puffer.
Uh-huh.
She smoked one cigarette after another right up until she went into a coma and lost consciousness.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. Wow. All right. Well, let's talk about your latest book and how you came about wanting to write. It's an interesting title. So I would like to know what was the genesis of this book? What made you decide to write it?
Well, we even thought about calling it The Survivor's Guide to UFO Contact, an Alien Abduction. But anyway, I decided to write this because I'm the director of the Mutual UFO Network's Experience or Research Team. And right now we have 30 compassionate individuals who speak with people who complete the experience or questionnaire on MUFON's website under the ERT page. And then that questionnaire goes to Dr. George Medich, who is the assistant director, and he assigns a member of the team to contact that person. We also have 5 professionals who we use as consultants, 2 psychiatrists and PhD psychologists, and then we also have a couple of research consultants as well. So this is research-oriented as well as support for people who believe they're having these experiences. And there are so many people, I realized when we started receiving 100 requests every month, that I ought to do something to give additional help to these individuals. And so this was the initial goal of the book. And I thought it was going to be a very small publication. I was calling it the Experiencer's Handbook. And then Red Wheel Wiser got a hold of it and thought that it would sell millions of copies. And ended up giving me a contract for a big book with a large publisher, which was very good, I suppose. But anyway, the intent of this book was to help people who are having these experiences or who believe they might be, how to separate out, how to investigate their own cases. There's so much information in this book. It is, there's no book on the market like it. It's a comprehensive guide to contact, to abduction, to And I give lots of very interesting stories about cases that I have personally investigated. I give some information about the history of all of this. We have chapters on coping strategies, even on how to make it stop if you feel you're having these experiences and you just want it to end. We give suggestions that have worked for other people.
Really? Because that's that's always been, my thoughts. You and I spoke briefly before the show, and I told you that this has always been a really tough part for me to swallow, and that I can't imagine how people can function if they actually have something like this going on in their lives. And I was listening to a couple of science podcasts just out of interest, and I was listening to one earlier today, and there's not going to be a real parallel here, but I will tell you there were people talking about really strange things happening when they were trying to sleep, and it ended up being carbon monoxide poisoning from their home, and they were they were having these visions of like people visiting them and sitting on the bed and talking to them and all this stuff. Now I know there's that when people just flat out want to say there's nothing to this. They'll come up with more of something like sleep paralysis. I've actually seen, a doctor on TV just saying this all bunk, and all that. I feel as though there's definitely something going on, and it's kind of like in the UFO world to me. Like, I don't have any idea what it is, but something's going on. Is that kind of how you see it, or do you think it's direct extraterrestrial?
There are many things going on. Some of it is extraterrestrial. Some of it's paranormal. Some of it's sleep paralysis. Some of it is mental illness or personality disorders where people are just big attention seekers and want all the attention they can get from everyone that will give it to them. There are all sorts of explanations for this. And that's one reason that we wrote the books, to help people to sort out what is actually occurring. And in terms of sleep paralysis, I also wrote in the book about social research studies that have been done on abductees and experiencers. Now, I did a 3-year study with Dr. Don C. Dondary, who has recently retired from McGill University, psychologist and statistician. And he administered the American Personality Inventory to 175 of our 516 participants. And what we did is we compared the overall data with the data supplied to us by people who were identified as abductees, not as simulators or wannabes, not as members of the general public, but had the characteristics, emotional and knowledge of alien abduction. And with regard to sleep paralysis, we asked the question, have you experience these symptoms, and we listed the symptoms. 74% of the experiencer group said yes, and 90% of the abductee group. But then we asked, were you awake? And did you then see non-human entities enter your environment before you became paralyzed? It dropped to 36%. For the experiencer group, but was 60% among the abductee group. So that was highly significant.
I remember you when I thought it was when you were working with Denise, maybe not, but that you found the likenesses that that people just seem to have that they'd fill out on their own, you know, like this and that would happen, and sure enough, you know, a lot of people are experiencing the same unusual thing. Some people do talk about, I know you've told this to me before, like the reptilian type entity they see, and the grays and the different types. Are there people that you talk with that describe something you've never heard before, a being that you've never heard that looked like what they're describing?
No, and when they do describe, well, let me say, when someone describes something that I have never heard before, it gives me and also my team a clue that this is something different. And Denise Stoner is the paranormal expert on our team. She has studied with Bishop Long from the ancient old Roman Catholic Church for about 2 years now, and she has convinced us that there are negative interdimensionals who slip in to our environment from time to time. And some of these entities that people believe are actually extraterrestrials, these highly negative ones, are not extraterrestrials at all. They're lower vibrating entities from, you might say, the astral realm. In the Catholic Church, they call them demons. They can shapeshift, and they will present sometimes as appearing somewhat like the extraterrestrials, but they're not. They look different. There are differences in their appearance.
Wow, how interesting. I know that someone's going to say, well, why didn't you ask her what to do about repelling them? So I'm going to ask you. If you can give a tidbit, I'm sure there's a lot of different things, but I know you don't want to give away everything in your book. But if you can just give us an idea of one of the things that someone might do that makes whatever is happening to them, stop.
Well, first let me say that for those who are having contact probably with interdimensionals from the astral realm, whether or not you're a religious person, appeal to a higher power. If you're an atheist, appeal to the highest intelligence. And the words that work for people are in the name of whoever it is, God, Jesus, Muhammad, whatever. I command you to leave this room now and don't come back. You can't scream it. You can't be angry. You have to say it very assertively and authoritatively. And if they really are extraterrestrials and they are benevolent, if you don't want them there, they will turn around and leave too. Now, many people believe that, particularly with the grays, which are the most prevalent group of entities that we believe are of extraterrestrial origin, with the grays, many people believe that humans had made a contract before they were born to work with the grays for the benefit of humanity at this time in the life of our planet, in our civilization, where we could be on the brink of destruction through an environmental collapse, through nuclear war, through that sort of thing. But still, if you believe that this might have happened or don't even know, just when you have an experience or telepathically, send the message, I want to break my contract. I don't like this. I don't want it to happen again. These kinds of things have worked for people. There, I have an entire chapter devoted to this with many, many ideas that have worked for individuals.
Isn't that something? I just have up on the message board, someone mentioned, Stephen mentioned, what about daytime abductions? So I do want to address that a little bit, because when someone is having a daytime abduction, generally speaking, there may be a witness sometimes, but oftentimes there's no witness at all. Are you familiar with any time that there's been a lot of witnesses?
No, I'm not. I know of witnesses in group abductions from conferences.
Oh, yes. The one in Coronado?
Yes, that's one of them.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And there have been others as well. I do know that one of the women on my team at MUFON believes that she had a daytime abduction at the International UFO Congress Conference in Phoenix 2 or 3 years ago.
Wow.
Where she went missing, couldn't find her. And there were people at that conference who reported that they had seen sort of almost invisible but barely visible non-humans at that conference. There's been a lot of talk. I haven't done an investigation of this, only to acquire information from other people's testimony. So we really don't know. But that is one case where she might have just, I don't know, slipped into another dimension or something happened into a portal and then was returned. And she was being sought after. She was manning one of the tables at the conference.
Hmm. Wow. Are you comfortable about talking about your own experiences?
I can tell you that after 50 years of non-disclosure, I have recently come to the decision that I needed to admit that this had indeed occurred in my own life, that I'm a generational experiencer, that my mother and I were both taken when I was 17 years old. And before that, there was a time when my mother went grocery shopping, and she did this every Friday night. She would leave at the same time, arrive home at the same time. On one particular night, she didn't show up. My father was extremely distressed. We were worried. Where could she be? She arrived home not realizing that she had any missing time. But the frozen food had thawed. The ice cream was soup.
Wow.
No explanation on what happened to her. And, you know, I think that maybe that abduction that I had when I was 17 years old, it was 1966, in the April of 1966. We had already had a close encounter with a UFO a couple of months before that. And this was during a time when Betty was working with a team of scientists to try to call in UFOs on kind of a CE5 experiment. They called it a psychophysics experiment. She was sometimes successful in doing this. The UFO came in on that particular night. Betty wasn't there. We'd all gone to bed. My grandmother and a neighbor of ours who was a commercial pilot returning home from work that night observed that craft coming in for a landing. It left physical trace evidence on the ground. It was scientifically investigated. But my mother and I never stated that we found ourselves on that craft that night. It was incredibly traumatic for us. But investigators worked with us, not immediately, because we didn't even mention it immediately, but a few years later, to help us with this. And Dr. James Harder, who was a professor in California and worked as an investigator for APRO, the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, did hypnosis on both my mother and myself. And it was because when we had these experiences just one time, they didn't stop. We were both taken time and time again over our lifetime. I believe that mine might have stopped now, but I will never know.
Yeah, right. Now, did you and your mother talk about this? Was it ongoing with her as well?
Yes, they came to her house. They terrified her. She had a terrible struggle working through this. Much, I think, probably worse than to be alone. She would divorce. I never lived alone. And probably because I didn't want to be alone. And so she did have a huge struggle with this, a great deal of fear, finding herself locked out of her house sometimes at night. She needed more help. She needed more support. And that's part of the reason why I do what I do today, because I know the impact that this has on people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether it ends up not being a UFO abduction, it could be something else, too. But we try to assist people in determining exactly what it is. And I always tell people who are feeling traumatized to do not go to a certified hypnotist or hypnotherapist before you have had psychological help. Now, some psychologists will also incorporate hypnosis into their work, but also there are many who just do EMDR therapy. It's an emotional release technique that is highly successful in resolving post-traumatic stress disorder, and these experiencers will have some memories of what happened as well. So I always recommend that before you explore your events through hypnosis.
I see. Now we only have a couple of minutes left. I do want to, and before you leave, of course, I want to ask you how people can find your book. I'm sure it's on Amazon and all that. But can you describe entities? And did your mother see the same thing you did?
I saw a race of grays, the same type that contacted Betty and Barney, abducted them in New Hampshire's White Mountains. You know, remember Betty was doing this experiment to call them in, and my mother did as well. It was always, but they were, you know, in the end, after I went through hypnosis and really remembered what was occurring, I was okay with it. I was terrified because I didn't remember everything. I remembered part of it, mm-hmm. but not all of it. But once I was able to remember all of it, they were not bad at all. They were pretty nice, actually, for grays. You know, when I say that, some people laugh in my face. But, you know, there are a lot of highly negative comments being made about the grays. Some of them are not as nice, especially the ones who work with insectoids. But this group was different.
How about
that? They were caring.
And your book, the title one more time, and people can find it on Amazon and et cetera?
It is Extraterrestrial Contact, What to Do When You've Been Abducted. It's available in multiple formats at Amazon and Barnes & Noble. You can purchase an autographed copy from me through my website at Kathleen-Marden, MARDEN.com.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Kathleen. It's always a real pleasure to see you and to talk to you.
Thank you, Martin. It was a pleasure to be with you again.
All right. Excellent. All right, everyone. We'll be right back right after these messages, and on YouTube, hang in there. We'll be right back as well. is Martin Willis, and my guests now are Stacy Wright and Marianne Robb from Phoenix MUFON. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I had the real pleasure of actually working with you, Marianne, and hanging out with you, Stacy, out in Phoenix. It was a lot of fun. I enjoyed our conversations, and that's why you're here.
Well, thanks for having us.
Yeah. So Phoenix is a very active area, and you do a lot. And in the background, for those on YouTube, you can see they got the little MUFON thing in the background there. A little echoey room. You're in a big room somewhere, huh?
Yeah. You know, in Phoenix, everyone's got tile floors just to stay nice and cool. So, yeah, you're probably hearing the tile echo.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's okay. We can certainly live with that. So do you want to talk about, either one of you can take this and talk about your backgrounds and what, you know, we'll do one at a time, how you got interested in UFOs and how you landed where you are today.
Okay. Well, I'll go first. I, you know, just grew up as a kid interested in the stars. You know, my favorite thing to do always was to go out in the backyard. Go
this is Stacy. Stacy speaking, just so the listener knows. Yeah, keep going. Yeah.
And so, you know, I just was always interested in the stars. They just kind of drew me. And it was always very fun to look up the stars and see every once in a while a shooting star. I think we all kind of grew up liking that kind of stuff. So when I went to college, I, you know, wanted to choose a college that had a really good astronomy program. So I actually moved from Lake Tahoe area in Nevada up to Idaho, to Idaho State University. And they had a good astronomy program up there. So I took a lot of classes and learned a lot more good stuff. Wow. And didn't really follow UFOs too much, just like the science end of things. And then about 12 or 13 years ago, I just all of a sudden something flipped like a light switch, and the UFO subject was all there was to look into at that point. So I just started researching and thought, you know, living here in this world-class city of Phoenix, you know, Jim Mann and I were talking. We thought there's got to be a UFO meeting here. You know, let's go find some weirdos and people wearing foil hats and let's go see a UFO meeting. That would be a lot of fun. So I went looking around, found this group called MUFON, and wrote in to the, I didn't know it at the time, but it was the executive director, and said, hey, how come there's no meetings here in the Phoenix area? It looked like it had been dormant for 7 or 8 years. And this was following the Phoenix lights, which was really unusual as well.
Right.
So he said, well, you know, we don't have a meeting there right now, but give me a couple weeks and we'll have one for you. So lo and behold, MUFON meeting formed and they were looking for someone to run it. And we just raised our hands and went from 4 people at our first meeting up to about 150 consistently in attendance now every month.
I know it's so, a very strong group, very strong. I've heard that for years. And
yeah,
what about you, Marianne?
Well, mine is a whole different story. Back in 2014, my husband went to the UFO Congress, told me about it and said, can I go? He heard it on the radio station. He says, please have fun. I believe that there is life outside of course, the Earth. And I, you know, I always believed, but I let him go to the UFO Congress, enjoy yourself. He did that in 2014. Then he asked me if I'd go to a meeting with him with Phoenix MUFON. He got to meet Alejandro and he got to, with Open Minds. He got to meet Jim and Stacy with Phoenix MUFON. So middle of 2014, he asked me to go to a meeting with him, which I did. And of course, being a police officer, I was a little skeptical. And I went to the meeting and lo and behold, of all people that were talking, it was Kathleen Martin. And she had me hooked from the beginning. It was an awesome meeting. It was wonderful. Met Jim and Stacy. They were just amazing. Started kind of getting into a little bit of a MUFON. My husband continued to go to the meetings. I didn't. Well, the end of 2014, I believe it was November, Jim and Stacy asked if we would house a couple of speakers that were coming in for the Travis Walton Skyfire Summit that was happening in November of 2014. And we said, sure, you know, no problem. Who are these folks? And at first they said it was Richard Dolan and Peter Robbins. Of course, we're like, who are they? And we got to meet those gentlemen, which were just amazing, great researchers and awesome people. Well, while we were that evening, we said, well, we have one other person that needs a room to stay before they go up to Heber the next day. And we're like, okay, sure. Who's that? Stanton Friedman.
All right.
And it was like, first of all, who's Stanton? Well, let me tell you, the whirlwind of everything started that next morning when I got to meet Stanton was just the most amazing time of my life. I had to go to work and I came home for breakfast and Stanton's sitting there in my kitchen and he looks at me and I look at him because I'm in a uniform, police uniform. He had no clue who I was. And listening to Stanton, Peter, and Richard.
He probably thought it was a raid.
He had no clue. It's like, who are these people and why is there a officer?
Why aren't you wearing black?
Anyway, it was the most amazing, amazing time. And ever since November of 14, my life has totally changed. Being part of MUFON has just been the most amazing, wonderful experience.
Wow. Well, during 2014, at that time, I had talked to Travis ahead of time and said, hey, Travis, I'm going to send you, there's no phone signal up there. And is it called Hubert? How do you pronounce that?
Hebert?
Hebert.
Yeah.
So he said there was no, you know, cell signal. So I said, okay, I'm gonna rent a satellite phone and send it to you. And I want you to be on the phone with me during my live show. And so he goes, great, sure, okay. And, you know, so the time comes and everyone is at the site and Travis isn't there. And my show's live. And so I got Alejandro on the show. And Alejandro's walking around and he did have signal enough to talk. And then he goes, oh, here's Travis. And he walks over to Travis and hands the phone to Travis. I said, Travis, light up the satellite phone. He goes, oh, I forgot that. So we ended up doing the show on the cell phone with Alejandro's cell phone. It worked out okay, but that must have been fun. Did you participate in that, either one of you?
Yeah, both of us were there helping to run the whole thing because it was just it was kind of the pilot program for his event that would be held the next year, and that would be his 40th anniversary of his abduction. So we were doing a little pilot program the year before, and it turned out great. I mean, it was freezing cold. It was so cold, it was unbelievable. And it was in this big barn that barely had heating, and there was no hot coffee or hot chocolate or anything sold anywhere around there. I mean, we're out in the country.
I think I take that back. I think it was that year. I think it was the 40th when I actually did speak with him. Yes.
Yeah.
From what I understand, that was a lot of fun. I heard that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was. The next year it was at the same place, but the heating was a little bit better, and then Phoenix MUFON jumped in there, and we did concessions. So everyone had hot drinks.
Oh, you actually had food.
You know, yeah. A lot of fun stuff. Yeah. And Karen Broad, who is the owner of the UFO Congress, she was running that 40th anniversary event for Travis. So it turned out really well because she does a really good job that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So
now she's running the UFO Congress and does a great job. I actually got to hang out with her and Alejandro in New York a couple of weekends ago, and it was funny. I said to Karen, I said, Karen, you're a real person. And the reason I said that, because she's totally stressed out during the UFO Congress, and I get that because I've run events before, and it's very, very stressful. And you have to be on target all the time. So, but interesting. So, Marianne, you are a police officer. I remembered reading that in your bio. What do police officers in general, do you ever get to talk to colleagues, and what do they think about the UFO topic?
My team that I work with Sergeant Hansen and my guys, really support me, really support the UFO phenomenon. They ask me a lot of questions. I have not had any ridicule at all from anybody in my police department.
That's nice.
More people, it's amazing. More people says, well, I have seen this. They come up with stories. They tell me things that they have seen in the past where they would never tell or share with anybody else. And it's pretty cool because I've had Stacy ride with me. That's an interesting story in itself.
Ride along with Carrie Ann is fun. Yeah, it's eventful.
I've had Peter Robbins ride with me. I've had Mark D'Antonio ride with me. And it's a lot of fun because my guys that I work with get to see the folks that I interact with the UFO community. And they just love it. I even, tell them about the show tonight, and they were excited that I'm really getting into everything with the UFO community.
Yeah, awesome. Now, when you say you ride, they just ride in the cop car basically with you. But are you familiar with any colleagues having or are there any instances that you're aware of where the Phoenix Police Department got involved in a UFO sighting? I know that there was tons and tons of calls the night of the Phoenix lights. We can talk about that a little later. But that was a long time ago. But, I mean, since you've been with the department, are there any sightings that are reported directly to the police?
Well, I work for Gilbert Police, and which is kind of southeast of the valley here, Phoenix area. Mm-hmm. We have not had any sightings. I don't know about Phoenix Police, which I could imagine what they probably have daily sightings. I haven't had a sighting, but I've actually had a woman that believed that her boyfriend was an entity. And
that's a good way to get rid of someone.
And she this was her boyfriend. I went to the house, and what's cool about being part of MUFON is that I know how to talk to these folks. The gal thought that her boyfriend, whose name was Lucifer, in a good way, he had his name Lucifer to show that
name.
It was a positive. He was putting a positive spin on the name.
Oh, okay.
And she actually,
how do you do that?
That's what she told me.
Yeah.
So anyway, she actually believes that she was impregnated by him, and she took her and her three small children out to a remote area in the Phoenix area in the middle of the night, waiting for his spaceship to come down and pick her up and pick up the children, because she was going to live happily ever after. One of my other partners that I was with had no clue how to even interact with this gal. And she talked about that. And then she talked about Stephen Greer, knowing Stephen, and listening to his talks. And she believed 100% what he was saying. Again, my partner had no clue who Stephen Greer was. Being part of MUFON, I've heard of Stephen. I've seen a couple of his talks. And I was able to interact with her, and I was able to connect with her. And I knew
so,
that.
So you speak UFO.
I speak UFO.
Her partners knew that she spoke UFO, so they chose her for this case And
I was able to get her, and we did get her help. We took her to a facility to get her some help. And it was just an interesting case that she did not want to talk to the police. She did not want to talk to anyone regarding this, but because I guess I did speak UFO, that helped her ease her into trusting me, and I was able to get her in my patrol car and took her to a mental health facility to get some help on that.
Yeah.
So I haven't had any sightings, but yeah, the entities and someone that believes that she was dating an alien, I got to help her out, so wow. I was real happy with that.
You can't say it's not possible. But anyway, well, that is interesting. That sounds like you handled it the right way. The woman sounds like she was struggling, so I'm glad you did that. Let's talk about the Phoenix lights, because we've touched on it like five times already. So the Phoenix lights, were either one of you interested at all in the topic at that time? Well, Marianne, I know that for sure that you weren't. But what about you, Stacy?
You know, I was here when it happened, but I did not see the Phoenix lights. I was not a witness to that. I didn't even know about it until the next day when someone from out of state actually phoned me and said, "Hey, you guys had a UFO last night." And I'm like, "We did?" So I never, really knew anything about it. And I wasn't really researching the subject at that time either. But it was years later when I got involved with MUFON. That was actually 2007. So since then, we still have people contacting us, maybe one person a month who will contact us and say, I was witness to the Phoenix Lights, but back then I just could not say anything about it. I felt like there was some reason that I should not say anything about it. But now is the time. I feel like I need to come forward and tell, you know, my part of the story. And a lot of people say they feel like there was some kind of a numbing effect that had come over them at the time and that they really just shouldn't speak about it. So now we're hearing some stories that are still coming in. And we do ask these people to report it in to MUFON just for historical, you know, data that we can keep in the database.
You must have so much information regarding that because think about, was it 1997, right? Isn't that when that was?
Yeah.
So long ago. And for people to still come forward, I can understand that. A lot of times people will say, I've had a number of people say on the show even that they've even forgotten about or like the next day, you know, didn't want to talk about it or whatever the case.
Yeah, it happens a lot.
Mm-hmm. And so, are they basically saying the same story?
Yeah, we're hearing a lot of different things from people, but there's a lot of similarities with all the cases. There's people that saw it in all parts of the state. So it didn't fly just over this major metropolitan city of 6 million people. It was in the outskirts as well. There was a lot of the tribe members up on the Navajo Nation who had been seeing UFOs flying around their valley, around the whole perimeter of their valleys for days before March 13th. And they just, you know, took it all in. This isn't anything new to them, though. These are just their star beings, their star brothers. They see this all the time. They don't talk about it because to them it's not an extraordinary event. It's just normal stuff. So, but they were taking their lawn chairs out and their ice chests and just sitting out in their front yards and watching the show at night. They were seeing a lot of stuff up there on the res. And then there was a lot of people here that saw craft. There were 7 or 8 craft that were actually sighted throughout Arizona. And I believe it even bled over onto the border of California a little bit, too. There were sightings of different shaped craft, daylight and nighttime. But again, the one that people know about is the big, you know, boomerang shaped craft that came over Phoenix right down the corridor, straight across this city at nighttime. And so we wonder, you know, what were they really doing? A lot of people say, well, you know, they came from Area 51, you know, direction. So they must have come from there. But when you look at that, really, you think, okay, well, if it was some super secret alien craft from Area 51, did it get loose? You know, did it get loose and just
all 8 of them?
Yeah. They were spread out throughout the whole area. It's a very kind of confusing thing to picture in your mind. But talking about that one craft, you know, it paraded itself basically right across the city. So if it was something of ours that, again, may have been housed up there in that area, super secret still, why would we then parade it over the top of this metropolitan city? It just doesn't make a lot of sense.
I've had someone argue that point and saying that's exactly why they did it, because they wanted to see what the reaction is, you know. And I'm not saying I agree with that, but it is an interesting take on that.
It's an idea. It could have been that they're trying to gauge our reaction and see how we felt about all this. But
it seems to me, now I may be wrong, but if in 1997 they had something that would do what that would do, it seems to me that it couldn't be held secret that long.
Yeah.
And that would be used somehow in military or some other use.
Right, some applications. But I, you know, what that thing did to fly so very low and so very slow and with zero sound.
And also huge.
I mean, we don't even have propulsion now that makes zero sound. All of our stuff is big engines and big noise and smoke and fire. You know, we don't have anything that doesn't leave a trail
that we know of anyway.
I think back then we had the technology to do something like that, and it was huge. So I think it was the real deal.
You know, Peter Davenport was on the show back on a number of different times, but on the last time he was on, he was talking about the Phoenix Lights because he was getting a report, and someone had calculated that thing was miles wide, not just 1 mile. wide, which is, it's just hard to understand.
Yeah.
And
it
seems like a night of an invasion if there was actually that many craft. And yeah, it's spectacular.
Uh-huh.
And this actually, didn't it go on a few different nights? Wasn't it on? Because didn't Fife Symington actually see it like on the second day or something like that? Or am I getting that wrong?
I don't think he saw it the second day, but he then later came out and claimed that he did see it.
Yeah, in a pot.
I don't know if it was the next day, but I'm not sure if I believe that story either. I have a problem with that. And being that he made such a big lying deal out of it at the beginning on camera, why would we then go and believe him saying, oh, yeah, I saw it? I mean, maybe he just wanted to jump on the bandwagon and improve, you know, improve himself in the eyes of the public, you know, to maybe get some pay his penance or something like that. But I'm not sure I really believe that. We have no reason to after that big, horrible lie he did and the fun that he made of everything. So it was really disgusting and really demeaning to the people who were witness to that craft, because that just ground them down to dust.
I saw somewhere where he apologized for that. Do you think it wasn't a good enough apology, if that's the case?
Correct.
Okay.
I think it was not a good enough apology, yeah.
All right. Yeah, that is demeaning. And because of so many people that did witness it, and his reasoning supposedly is that people were panicking and he wanted to, you know, break the ice and, you know, make people settle down and laugh at it instead. But you didn't see it that way at all, right?
No, I really didn't. You know, there was people that did some really big work on this, and Frances Barwood was one of them. She was the vice mayor. She jumped in there like a bulldog and tried to get some truths out of this, and it just didn't really work for her. They were on a campaign to belittle the whole thing and bring in that giggle factor on it, and that's exactly what they accomplished.
I was glad she was on the show here a few years ago for a short time, but she came on for a little while. It was really nice to have her on. I think she was a great advocate, and she's got on the phone and talked with a lot of people, right?
Yes, she did. Yeah. She fought for that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's just another one of those cases that will never be solved. I mean, it's come and gone. And I think the interesting aspect about it is that people are still calling in and saying that they witnessed it. Not that we'll get any new information, but people are saying that I have heard a few people have said this to me, that they've seen it since and they've seen it before. What do you know about any of that?
Well, I know there have been some sightings here that were on the news even. I think there was three different sightings of Phoenix Lights type lights in the sky. And I was witness to one of them just in 2008. My daughter and I both saw this and pulled over to the side of the road and sat there for 5 minutes and watched these lights. It wasn't in the direction of any one of our ranges that we have. You know, we have a lot of different firing ranges out here. So it was, I thought it was really anomalous. And I sat there and watched this and reported it in to MUFON, of course.
Wow. Did it have the strange lights that were talked about, the unusual lights as well?
Yep. It did. It wasn't, I didn't see a boomerang shape, but what I saw was something on an angle like this. And there was about five lights tilted up to the sky.
Wow.
And in an area where there was absolutely no reason for that. So, and it just sat there, and it wasn't flares.
Yeah, and about the flares, everyone says, you know, it was just flares. I've heard that, you know, over and over again. And if you talk to any skeptic about it, that's the first thing he says. And I understand that there was some talk about the flares that they didn't happen or did happen, or there wasn't a certain group says that no, it wasn't us. Do you know anything about that part of it?
Well, the sighting that happened over Phoenix, what the real deal that I believe was the real deal, was about 8:30 p.m. So by 10 o'clock that night, there were flares dropped south of here above the Barry Goldwater Range. If you talk to the Air Force or whoever was in charge of it, it was called Operation Snowbird. So it seemed like they needed to cover up with something that happened at 8:30. How are we going to explain this? We've got to say it's flares or something like that. So they brought in a group that went up there and dropped these flares. So people saw them at 10 o'clock as well. That's what you see on most of the video footage that you see on the news or any footage that you see with the Phoenix lights. It is those flares. So when people analyze that footage and say, oh, no, those are illumination flares. I know they are. I'm a video analyst. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you're right. That's exactly what they're seeing. But that wasn't the event that we're really talking about here.
And what about the real footage? Someone told me the other day, now I don't know, and I'm not saying she does or does not, but Lynn Cattai only has flare footage. I don't know if that, like I said, I don't know if that's true or not, but does anyone actually have footage of the craft before the flares?
As far as I know, no one has footage of that boomerang craft as it went across the sky here. I mean, these were the days when we didn't really have cell phones like people do now. They can just whip something out of their pocket and film something.
Yeah.
Back then, you know, it was at night. It was a little bit hidden. Unless you were looking up, you weren't going to see it. And we, as far as I know, there's no footage, especially no good footage of that event.
So that's kind of sad because it's always represented like on in films and on TV as what apparently is the flare lights.
Yeah.
And it's,
yeah,
it's,
it is sad.
Yeah.
That there's, you know, we have to base our evidence off of testimony. So we're not saying that it's proof. There's a mm-hmm. difference. We're saying that this is evidence. So we've got, you know, over 1,000 911 calls that came in that night. That's a lot. I mean, their boards were flooded. Have you ever heard of anything like that before?
No, not.
I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah.
And then estimated that there was over 10,000 witnesses, eyewitnesses to this event. So it's that testimony that we take that we can then consider evidence. When you get that much testimony, you have to say this is evidence.
And if you have that many people saying the exact same thing that have no idea who each other is or who,
yeah.
each, you know, you don't know who the other person is, and they're saying the exact same thing, you've got to take that to heart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is definitely evidence.
Marianne, I was when I had my UFO sighting, which was actually kind of boring compared to most UFO sightings, but I actually ran inside the house and I called the Carmel Police Department. I was in California and the Monterey, I believe it was the Monterey Police Department. And I can't really remember. That's terrible. But anyway, I sensed ridicule from the dispatcher. Do you think that, and I was put on hold for, I think I hung up after 15 minutes. Is that typical, do you think, or do you think there's more response today if someone would call the police department? And does the police department, as far as you know, get those type of calls?
I have not heard of our police department getting those kind of calls. I have not heard that at all. I think with the television shows that are coming out between Ancient Aliens, Disclosure, the Unidentified, and all of the Contact and all of the new shows that are coming out and the talk of the UFO phenomenon, that's I think all dispatchers are not going to go, oh, what a crackpot. And like, unfortunately, what happened to you is put you on hold for 15 minutes. I believe, and I don't get to interact with my dispatchers that much because where I work is a long ways away from our dispatch center. But I really doubt this day and age that person is going to be ridiculed, called a nut, and then just put on hold and hopefully they'll hang up. I really doubt that will happen on any police agency. With the government coming out and all of the Navy pilots and everybody that's been witnessing these strange lights, I think people are really coming on board and taking this serious. So I haven't heard, I don't work graveyard, I hate to say it, but I'm in bed by 7 o'clock usually at night and up at 3 o'clock in the morning because
wow.
I work day shift. And I have not heard any of our graveyard guys saying, hey, we got a call of lights in the sky. I really wish we were, because I would love to investigate
so
that.
So you, as a police officer, if you had an awesome sighting and you needed to report it to someone besides MUFON, who would you report it to?
Wow, good question. I'll let you take over the show.
Other than MUFON, National Reporting Agency, Police Department.
But they don't investigate it.
No, they don't. So
Peter Davenport doesn't investigate things.
True.
He just takes down your info. There's
right.
no investigation going on there. So would you call the Air Force base closest? Would you call the airport tower? Would you call the FBI?
Well, I'd probably call the Air Force.
Really?
Would they give us some information? I don't know.
No, they won't.
I tried all that.
I hope
nowadays they might give us some information, but that's true. So who do you call? MUFON's probably the only ones, and I'm not, I guess can be a little biased here because I am a field investigator. We do. MUFON does. As soon as we get a case, boom, Jim Stacy assigned it out to one of our field investigators, and we are on it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I guess that's really the only people.
Yeah. We've got a crack team of investigators here in Arizona. So we, you know, they're drilled and they are trained, and we've got 17 on board right now just in the state of Arizona, and they are good.
Wow,
I mean, I would
that's
put
great.
Up against anyone.
Let's talk about the sightings, because, by the way, I actually did call the Air Force when I had a sighting for, I had basically, it was a meteor. You know, a fireball. I didn't know, you know, I didn't know who to call. And that's, I did call the Air Force, and I didn't get anywhere with that one either. But anyway, let's talk about the sightings in Arizona. And are you ready to take calls? We can take calls if you'd like. And anyone can call in and just ask the ladies a question if you have one. And let me put that number up. That number is, hang on just a second. I had it up here. It is 85 KGRA Live, and that number is 855-472-5483. If anyone wants to call in, feel free to do that. And I'll have that number right up on YouTube right now. There it is. So what are the sightings like in Phoenix today? I mean, I know it's one of the places that there's a lot going on.
There's a little bit of everything going on. I mean, we've got a lot of sky here and a lot of people that are out doing things, you know, most months of the year. And
right.
you know, we've got all those people that are smokers and that are walking their dogs too.
Yeah, those are the ones that's where most of them come from, right?
Stuff. They're out having a smoke, or they're walking their dog, or both, and they're looking up while they're out there. So we get a lot of reports in like that, which we joke about, but we're thankful for that. But, you know, we do see a lot of meteors. Like you said, you saw a fireball. We do have a lot of those reported in. One of the big things right now are sky lanterns, the Chinese sky lanterns.
Oh, yes.
We have a lot of reports on that.
I hate those.
So, I mean, they're beautiful to watch, but yeah, they mess with the reporting system a lot. But, of course, then the satellites going by, the ISS, we have different things like that. And then occasionally, you know, pretty often we have some abduction cases, or people that think they've been abducted or have seen entities. Not many like craft that have landed. That would be great. We'd love to, you know, rush out on one of those kind of cases. But more of the abduction entity.
Missing time.
Yeah,
people
really?
Are getting the missing time, so they're assuming they possibly could have been abducted, because they're saying, what happened 30 minutes? What happened to my 30 minutes, 45 minutes? So that's one of the reports we get. Another big one is the stars, especially in the wintertime. The stars are so brilliant and bright, and they believe that when they stare up at one of them, that it's moving. Well, unfortunately, it's their eye that's kind of...
Yep.
You know, a play on the star, or maybe water in the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And they believe that is that's a craft that's moving around the sky.
Wow. I see we have a surprise guest that has called in. But first, we have Chris, who is calling in from New York. Chris, you're on the air. Welcome to
Hi,
the show.
Chris. Hello, ladies. How are you?
We're great.
Great, Chris. Great to hear you.
Oh, you know who Chris is.
Oh, yeah.
So I can say Chris from New York, and you know who that is. New York's kind of big, you know. Okay.
I would like to know from the two ladies, what is the most memorable case you guys got going in down in Arizona that you've investigated where you could say, wow, this is not only incredible, but there was enough evidence where you can actually say, without a doubt, this is an absolute sighting or encounter or abduction, one of the three.
Good question.
I haven't had one.
I think you stumped them.
You stumped us, Chris. I've gone on cases with Marianne where we have had, you know, what MUFON calls a Category 3 case, which is one of the higher up, more important, hurry, look into this case. So I've gone with Marianne. We have kind of a team that goes along. We've got someone, our chief investigator, who's a master videographer. So he's the one that does all the filming. We have interview that we do, and we've gone down to Tucson a couple of times on some cases where there had been an entity involved, right?
Yep. Oh, yeah. The gal, definitely. Yeah.
So that was really interesting. And actually, Marianne was the field investigator on that case. So I'm going to let her take it from here.
Yeah, let's hear the deets on that.
Well, the interesting thing is this person came up to the Valley area, the Metro Phoenix area, and I guess met a gentleman. They were talking. She went back down to Tucson where she lives, and at night she believed that she is being visited by an entity that she believes this person that lives up in the Phoenix area is remotely sending down to her and putting in her body. She's had numerous experiences. I don't think she had an implant or anything, but she would just have all these feelings.
Sexual things.
Encounters, that she said, everything was done remotely. It was real interesting on that. She had some drawings that she gave us. When we did the interview, it was interesting. Being a police officer, of course, I look at body language. I look at the listening to the voice inflections that she's had, what she's actually saying to see if she's being deceptive or not. And in her mind, 100%, this was happening to her remotely. The body language was, it was interesting. It was very, very interesting. But unfortunately, we didn't have any evidence, physical evidence, that this was actually happening to her. Just, unfortunately, her story on what happened.
Wow, interesting. Hey, Chris.
Was her story consistent? Yeah.
I was just going to say thank you for the call, but go ahead, answer.
No, I'm sorry, but yes, it was consistent.
Interesting. Thanks for the call, Chris.
All right.
Bye, Chris.
Yep. Thank you.
Good night.
Bye, guys.
Whoops, I think I cut him off. Now we have the one and only, I think, Mark from Connecticut with a C.
Mark from Connecticut.
Hello, Mark. Mark D'Antonio,
guessing.
Hey,
how are you?
Yeah, he's the only Mark in Connecticut.
Correct.
Yes. How are you, Mark?
I was calling because I'm good, man. Hey, Stacey. Hey, Marianne. How are you?
Great.
I'm just trying to – I had to call because I wanted to – mentioned to everybody so all could hear it that I believe the Phoenix model for how they run MUFON is probably the best in the entire country. And Stacy knows that's true. I've told her that before. The training they put people through. Well, you know, the people get trained when they go to, say, a MUFON boot camp that's run by Stacy and Jim. I mean, and now we've got some new faces that are going to be at the MUFON boot camp coming up. So I hope you get a chance to talk about that. If you didn't already, I'm sorry if I stepped on that.
No, we haven't yet.
I'm good. Oh, I can't wait. I'll be there Thursday.
Yeah, we've got the 2019 MUFON International Boot Camp that's being sponsored by Phoenix MUFON. It's going to be held this weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, November 8th, 9th, and 10th. And
did
Mark
you just
Antonio,
say, Mark, you're going to be there?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, Mark will be teaching us a lot of stuff, and he's going to hold a talk on astronomy, and he's also going to follow that up with a Skywatch that night, and he'll show us the real deal through some telescopes.
Hey, Mark, while I have you on the line, since you're the video analyst for and image analyst for MUFON, have you ever seen other video other than the flares at the Phoenix Lights?
You know, when you mentioned that earlier, my first thought was I've been seeking that footage as well, if any such footage exists. But, you know, it really caught people off guard. They didn't expect to see it. People are used to seeing things on the Goldwater Range. Let's put it this way, okay? Phoenix has a history of seeing parachute flares, and people that see them get used to them. They know what they look like. They know where they are typically, so they understand what they're supposed to look like. This event was different. Yes, there was a flare event. Yes, okay, get that out of your system. There was a flare event. Okay, this was not that. This was not just around the Goldwater Range and the other areas that people have seen them, okay? This was something that occurred in multiple locations in Arizona. And there was a flight path, a potential flight path that something could have taken. I think that makes all the difference. And frankly, the jury is still out for me. I used to think it was just a flare event. Yeah, I got arrogant about it. Ah, just flares. But you know what? You have to really pay attention to all the many reports. And when you look at all the reports that came in, and Marianne will tell you about the number of 911 calls. Stacy knows. She's fielded so many calls. The newspapers have. Clearly, the people who live in that area don't call in about flares. They're used to them. They see them all the time. Mm. I saw my own when I was out there in the desert, you know, doing photography. I actually saw a flare event and said, oh, look, my own, quote unquote, Phoenix light. So.
And were they in formation too, Mark? Like in a formation? Yeah, I mean, is that what they are always like?
Well, yeah, they're being released from planes. You know, so they come out in a linear line, and the first one to come out is the first one to go out if it's a parachute flare, and it drops down slowly. And everybody out there knows what they look like. They know the unearthly orange glow that they have. Mm-hmm. And so I think clearly, you know, you get Stacy on a job with guys like Dave that works with Marianne and Jim, and you have all these other people that recognize what flares are. They know what they are, and you can't negate that. You know, and that was a mistake I made early on with this case. I just said, "Well, everybody's wrong." I'm like, well, what do I know? You know, that was like a stupid thing to say. But you know, nowadays I realize that's not all the evidence there is. The evidence really goes beyond the one little piece of footage that you see, which is usually the flare event.
Right. Right. That's what I'm familiar with. Well, Mark, I actually had fun hanging out with you a couple of weeks ago. That was a lot of fun.
It was. Yeah, it was nice. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
These guys here, you got Stacy and Marianne. They're the hot shots of Phoenix MUFON right now.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that about the boot camp. We will talk about that in just a minute. Mark, it's always a pleasure.
Hey, thanks, guys.
It's always a pleasure when you're on this show as well. You take care. And, Mark, just give yourself a plug. Sunday nights, your show?
Yeah, KGRA Sunday nights, 8 to 10 Sunday nights, KGRARadio.com, Sky Tour Radio, 2 hours of astronomy and extraterrestrial life. We talk about it all. It's fun. But thank
Excellent.
You.
Excellent. Thanks, Mark. You take care.
All right.
See you in a couple
night,
days,
guys.
Mark. Bye, Mark. See you Thursday.
Okay.
Yeah, that's great. All right, now we have another caller, and you probably know who he is, but I don't really know. Do you happen to know a Ron from Minnesota?
Yes, I do.
Do
Hi,
you really?
Ron. Yes. Ron.
Hey, Ron, how you doing? Welcome
Hi,
to the
Mark.
Show.
All right. Thank you for the call, and thank you for the show. Great show. Thank you, and thank you, Marianne, and your other guest. I forgot her name
Stacy.
Already. Sorry.
Yeah.
The question I have for all of you, and it's for everyone in the community, what is or how has your level of skepticism changed since your original sighting or your initial sighting? Has your skepticism changed, or is it still are you still somewhat skeptical in some of the areas of the UFO world?
Anyone could take that?
Yeah, that's anyone's question.
So, Ron, you're saying is my family?
No, he wanted...
No, just with you yourself, personally. Are you Are you more skeptical or less skeptical, or do you have solid continuity with what you believe as what you think are flying saucer or UFOs? Or
100%. I believe, even though all my life I have never seen anything, even before I got into MUFON and became a field investigator any of it before 2014, I believe, with all due respect to everybody out in the radio world, is that you would be a fool not to believe that we are not alone in this universe. There are, I would say, many, many, many different planets, different, I don't know, I'm going to say people, but I know it's probably not people, but there are plenty of different worlds out there. If I've never changed my skeptic, even though I wasn't involved in the UFO community before 2014, I believe we are not alone out there. Real quick story about that is that when Mark D'Antonio was out doing the boot camp last year, one of the things he taught us was, if you look at Cassiopeia, the big W, and put your fist up straight up ahead of you, it just in your fist area is 40,000 exoplanets. 40,000 in W of Cassiopeia. And it's like, wow. And that's just the smallest, tiniest little area. But again, my thing is, no, I'm still as strong, if not stronger today, in my belief that, yes, there are other worlds out there.
Anything to add? Thank you. That's good to know.
Anything to add to that, Stacey, at all?
Well, I believe the same thing. I mean, it would be extremely arrogant of us to think that we are it out here in this universe.
I like that.
And God help us if we are, because we're failing. So, you know, there's a lot more stuff out there. But, you know, it is good. And we all have a healthy sense of skepticism to begin with. And that is a good thing. You can't just go out there believing every single thing that you see or you hear.
Yeah.
So when you're in this arena for quite a while, you seem to develop what's called a bullshit meter. Mm-hmm. And you can hear certain things and know certain things from people's stories.
I'm not sure if we could say bullshit on this show.
I know. I'm sorry.
But anyway.
I'm failing now. Sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. I'll put in my two cents too, Ron.
Okay.
And that is, you look at, you look at how life fights to be here. And we have examples of that, that they're finding in, you know, acidic places and dark areas where maybe a photon, a light or two can hit the ocean floor, that type of thing under the ice. They're finding life. Yeah. Life fights to be here. And whether, it'll evolve into something intelligent, but most likely it possibly has many, many times over. I truly believe that there must be something out there. Anyway, thanks for the call.
Yep, thank you for the show. All right.
All right.
Thanks, everyone.
All right, so we can still take one more call if someone would like to call in. That number is 855-472-5483. Thanks to Race over there for screening the calls. And let's talk about the boot camp, because I think I did hear Mark talk about that at one point. But let's talk about that. What is that exactly, and what do you train, and how do you train? Is it like a real boot camp? You gotta get up in the morning and do push-ups and all that and run 10 miles?
No, we're
a little easier than that.
That's good, because I'd be out.
We do try to plan everything that we do here with a good element of fun, because if you don't have the fun in it, you're not enjoying it, you're not going to stick with it.
Yes.
So we've got planned for this weekend is Friday night. We've got just a fun little icebreaker meet and greet thing at a fun little bar and grill right there next door to the hotel. And then the next day we've got 4 hours of classroom work where we're going to be doing advanced interviewing techniques. And that class will be instructed by officers Marianne Robb and Dave Rich. We've got a class that's called Healthy versus Unhealthy Mental States. And that is being taught by the director of psychiatry at the VA hospital. Mm-hmm. We have a couple of really awesome cases that two of our field investigators are going to go through. We have someone else instructing on what the ERT does. And the ERT is MUFON's experience or research team. And when someone has an experience that just rocks their world and they cannot handle it emotionally, they need someone to talk to, help them through this. The ERT has counselors and psychologists and hypno people that can really help these witnesses through that. So we've got someone from the ERT team that's talking about that. Again, we'll have Mark D'Antonio giving us an astronomy lesson. We will have our chief investigator here in Arizona, Dennis Freiermuth. He's going to be handling the photo and video analysis class. And then in the afternoon, wow, those are just the morning classroom sessions. Then we're going to go out to the desert both afternoons, Saturday and Sunday. And we've got the Arizona Navajo Rangers out there teaching us forensic field work for 5 hours. So this is just a top-notch lineup, stuff you can't get anywhere else. And it's going to be great fun. We did this last year. We're kind of following the same plan again this year, and it's just going to be awesome.
Are there any other states that either want to follow this model or that are looking into following this model? I mean, it sounds really interesting.
Well, and this isn't just a state thing from Arizona Move On. We just happen to be putting it on because we have a lot of the talent here within our group to do that.
Oh, this is but national.
Jane Farzan will be here. He's the executive director of Move On. He'll be here as well. Mm-hmm. Just to have fun. Jan is not talking. He's just coming along to see what we're doing and have fun. But this is representing all of MUFON International. It's a worldwide organization. So we have people coming from all over the United States and from Canada on this one. Last year, we had some people signed up from the UK and Australia and different places like that. So it's really an international thing. And yes, I think that other states would probably love to be doing this. And I don't know what MUFON has in store for the future boot camps. This is just the second one that we've had in a row here in Arizona. So we hope to see them continue. And I know there's a lot of talent throughout all of MUFON. So I'm hoping that maybe they can take this on the road somewhere as well.
Well, I had no idea. But and I'm glad that, you know, the MUFON International is doing this. And because that was going to be one of the questions, it sounds so interesting, but how could you possibly get funding in a state, you know, at a state level to do something like this? So this is actually...
Well, it's a lot of creative resources. I mean, we have a lot of people here that have this talent just within our own area. So we tried to keep using our people so that we don't have to pay airfare for a lot of other experts to come in from other places when we've got it right here among us. So we're using our resources here and saving MUFON a lot of money and spending and doing this. So the funding is just happening. You know, Phoenix MUFON is coming up with some of the funding and MUFON International is coming up with most of it, and it's just working.
That's excellent. Stacy, you and I spoke. We did a sound test last night, and I told you, and I'm going to just tell this story real quickly because we only have I don't think we have time. We only have a minute. But I had mentioned to you about a sighting that someone I talked to at the casino out there in Phoenix where the UFO Congress was, where they saw this black triangular object go over their car. They hit the gas, and it was a passenger in the car that was telling me the story, and she didn't even know the UFO event was going on there. She just started talking about it, and that when they parked, I think she said 9 or 10 miles later, this big, huge owl came right at them. And you said that there was some type of object that is seen a lot out there. And I think we're going to have to wrap this up real quick, less than a minute.
Okay. Well, I know that there's a couple of screen events that happen to people when maybe they're seeing aliens or extraterrestrials, and they might be screened as something like a deer or an owl. Those are two of the most common screen animals that portray themselves. It might be because of the big eyes. I'm not really sure exactly, but we had an owl event ourselves on the way out to one of our Phoenix MUFON Skywatches. Wow. So it's not unheard of.
Wow. So we are totally out of time. I'm so sorry to do this to you, but I'm going to have to cut you short. Thank you so much, both of you. It was just wonderful. I really appreciate it. And I hope to talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Okay, everyone. I have to run. I'm sorry. That's it. Next week, we'll be back with Preston Dennett, and we're going to be talking about schoolyard sightings. So thanks so much, and remember to keep your eyes to the sky.